This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
With that, we'll formally start. This is a session that is going to be about South Asian organizing in North America. Just as to help sort of like introduce the topic, as some of you might know, South Asia is not essentially a monolith entity or a region that we understand it to be. It comprises of some countries, some of which have been at war with each other multiple times, some of which are at sort of like a permanent situation of conflict with each other. And this is also a region that comprises of various and a great number of differences along ethnic, religious, caste, class lines. So when we talk about South Asia, it's not really a definitive unidimensional category as we might think it to be. And today we're going to talk about how diaspora has recently emerged as a site where some sort of a consistent political formation across South Asian lines and not across individual, say, Indian or Pakistani or Bengali lines can be possible. And this is a task for the organizers to think about whether such a political formation is possible or not. Secondly, why are South Asians in North America? What were the reasons that there were like multiple waves of migration? Primarily 60s onwards, we see a lot of folks coming in, a lot of families abandoning their places in South Asia, and they were doing that because of various push factors, as we understand, some of which were, say, dictatorships in various countries where a lot of people were escaping their homelands to find a place where they can access liberty and freedom while taking care of their families. We've also seen recently that climate emergencies have emerged as a major push factors in forcing people abandoning their homelands and coming into North America. So essentially 60s onwards, we see South Asians, waves of migrations from South Asia into the North America. And recently we have seen that South Asians have relatively emerged as a sizable proportion of the working class in North America, especially in the service sector. If you go into, say, a city like New York, you see that majority of taxi drivers, restaurant workers, care workers are from South Asia. So why are we talking about organizing particularly the South Asian communities in North America? Is because a sizable chunk of the working class here has started to have this South Asian element to it. And that is why it is important to look at South Asia as a possible political formation to help organize the working class in general. So I'll start with introductions. I'll introduce myself. My name is Raza Gilani. I'm originally from Lahore, Pakistan. I was part of the left in Pakistan and the student movement in recent years for like a decade now. And I've been here for 2 years and I've been working with organizations like Drum and Salaam. So I'll request all the panelists to introduce themselves, their organizations and their work.
Thank you, Raza, and good afternoon, everyone. My name is Mohiba Ahmed. I'm also originally from Pakistan. I was also a part of the student movement as well as the working class movement in Pakistan, part of the Pakistan left for the past 6 years. And for the past 3 years, I've been in the US, and currently I'm working as the Pakistani organizer at Drum, Forum, they seize Rising Up and Moving, which is a base building organization that is based out of New York City, that mobilizes, organizes the working class South Asian and Indo-Caribbean communities. So yes, I'm excited to be here today.
Thank you for that introduction, Raza. My name is Aman. I use they, them pronouns. I am originally from Ahmedabad in India. I've been in this country for too long, no, 12 years now. And I've been involved in multiple, I've been very fortunate to be, to have the chance to be involved in multiple union, taxi worker, and student movements. And in the past few years, I've been very involved in diaspora-based organizing, both Indian diaspora and South Asian diaspora. And I'm part of SALAM, South Asian Left. We are a political organization based out of New York City. And the idea is to grow the political consciousness, unite different aspects of South Asian organizing in this country, and towards building a South Asian political formation from the left. Yeah, excited to be here.
Hello, everyone. My name is Arsalan. I'm from, well, originally I'm from Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, Pakistan, and I've stayed in Toronto for over 18 years now. Where I've organized with multiple organizations, mass organizations. Right now, though, I'm part of a radical media project called Jamhur. It's a media project that serves both the talks about issues in South Asia as well as the issues that are dealt by the South Asian diaspora community in Canada, North America generally, and the UK. And the Caribbean. So it's a forum where we're trying to build solidarities within South Asian communities or different South Asian communities and with the wider struggle of other places.
I'm sorry, what is the name of the
Jamhoor. So jamhoor.org. Please donate to Jamhoor. Find a page like that.
Hi, everyone. I'm Divyani. I am a graduate student at the University of Toronto, is how I landed in North America, basically. I come from UP, which is one of the provinces in India. I was largely part of the student movements in Delhi University, also in JNU, like another university in India, and that's sort of the politics I'm coming from. And when I landed in Toronto, I think I landed in the moment when the CAA, NRC, like some bills were being passed in India. And it is through the solidarity movements here that I got introduced to a lot of organizations, including Jamhoor. So I am I'm an editor with Jamhoor, and I also do the social media for Jamhoor. But that's sort of, yeah, the background I'm coming from. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. I think it would be useful to start with some sort of an introduction into the history of South Asian organizing. I mean, what is the political history that we've inherited in North America, what has been happening in the last 4 or 5 decades. And I think it would be useful to talk about that so that we can understand what we have inherited and based on that, what we can possibly do in the future. So, see, Aman, if you can talk about how and what is sort of like the evolution of South Asian organizing in North America, particularly the U.S.?
Yeah. So I think it would be very useful to spend a few moments before we get into South Asian organizing to also cover a little bit of the context of why is there such a diaspora here, and what do they look like, right? So, I mean, South Asian migration to the U.S. has been conditional. Like, it's really a question of, we have to ask ourselves, who is it that migrates? Who is it that gets to migrate? How do they migrate, and at what cost? And I think a key question within these questions is that why have people migrated from South Asia in the first place, from different regions across South Asia? And it's something that is born both in at home and at abroad, right? And I mean, in the most immediate sense, it's out of desperation. It's a form of escape. It's an aspiration towards a better life. But when you look at the home states, and you see the rise, like, you know, across different countries in South Asia, you see the rise of capitalism, of neoliberal policies, austerity being implemented, of fascistic forces, of authoritarian states becoming more prominent. That's a key factor that contributes to that. And together with, when you look outside structurally, with the imperialist draining that happens and the othering of the forced, like, underdevelopment of these different South Asian states that happens internationally, that also leads to them not being spaces where you can find jobs. They're not being spaces where you can afford a life. So people are forced to come here so that they can send money back and sustain their families. Right, like, so I think that's a very key context in which we are understanding South Asian migration. So, like, just I'll brush up very quickly on the history. So there have been, I would say, 4 major waves of migration from different regions in South Asia. The initial one was, like, up until 1923. And these were largely, indentured laborers and a few people like who were able to come here to study at universities. Very few professional classes, very few business people. And after the 1920s, there was a complete dip in migration because the U.S. banned people from British India to come to the U.S. And after the next wave started in late 1960s, actually on the backs of winds from the civil rights movement in the U.S. that allowed for a certain loosening of immigration regulations that allowed just the professional classes to come here from different countries in South Asia. And so that formed a very important part of the diaspora that we see today. The next wave started from early 90s, late 80s, and this is also a result of what I was mentioning earlier, like that was also the period where neoliberalism like really strengthened its hold in different states in South Asia. So I mean, to escape, like being in a place where you are suddenly left without a social safety net and to be able to afford and live a better life, there was a huge migration that started that was largely working class populations. So that's where, when you go to New York City, the largest taxi workers alliance is formed 80% of just South Asian folks. And this is really, on the backs of the migration that started in the 90s. And then later on, like in the past, like decade and a half or so, from 2010 onwards, there has been significant increase, like it's the numbers are wild, of how many people have been coming here, crossing the border, or overstaying the visas from South Asia. So those are like the large migrations. And as a result of the migrations, what we have in terms of demographics, I mean, just to give a sense of like what is the population that we are dealing with here, they're about like I think something like 6 million people in the U.S. Who are of South Asian heritage, and they have from 2000 to now, it's been a threefold increase. So this is a huge difference that we are seeing currently, and I think that also points to what Raza was mentioning earlier: the importance of like organizing within South Asian communities. I mean, out of them, obviously, the ethnic group that stands out the most are Indian Americans. Which form the bulk of that 6 million, about 4.2 million or so. And that's also the group which is the richest ethnic minority in this country right now. It's number one, and I think somewhere 5 to 7 is the rank for Pakistani Americans, and then both of these are higher than white Americans. So that's a very significant factor. Together with that, this is what you see. Like, there are, I think, two different South Asian Americas that you usually see. So like on the one hand you have this, and on the other hand what you have is a large number of people here without documents. So just in the years 2022 to 23, what we see is the highest number of people who were apprehended at the border coming from India. And the number is close to 100,000. And so this is just the numbers that we know of. And even in the demographics that I outlined, like those are just the numbers that we know of. There are actually way more people than that. And so there have been also significant increases amongst Pakistani, Nepali, and Bangladeshi migrants crossing the border and being here without documents. The same thing with students. Indians comprise. They just surpassed China last year, 2 years ago, as the country that sends the most number of students to this country, and it's somewhere like 100,000. Okay, I'm at time, so I'm gonna skip the context for a little bit. We can get into that in the questions later on. I'm sorry for boring you, but I thought it was important to frame outside. Okay, so moving on, the position of South Asian migrants in the U.S. is extremely significant. They are present in business, tech, in industry, politics, like everywhere that you see. And they are important in both ways, not just in influencing U.S. society, economy, and politics, but also the diaspora is significantly influential in the politics in different countries within South Asia. So, for instance, the party in power in India, BJP, used to receive, its largest source of funding used to come from the US up until 2013, and that's what we know of. We are not sure about the funding sources after that. Gotabaya Rajapaksa, who was deposed from power in a coup two years ago from Sri Lanka, his son lives in the US. Sheikh Hasina's relatives are based in the US. Imran Khan, for instance, in Pakistan, his party, PTI, raises significant funds from the U.S., and that helps it run it. So like the politics are very deeply embedded. The diaspora doesn't end in the U.S. They influence the politics back home very significantly, going back to take positions and so forth. Okay, so I'll get to what Raza actually asked me to do. I'm sorry, I can talk about this for a very long time. So thank you for that reminder. The history of left politics in the US is as old as the South Asian diaspora. So before 1920s, there was a party called Ghadar Party, which was composed of a few thousand numbers of Sikhs and Punjabis who were living in California, and they put an ashram together called the Ghadar Ashram, and then they formed a party around there. And the party's purpose was to liberate India from the British Empire. And they had a newspaper, they had training sessions, they gathered arms, they even got on a ship and came to the port of Bombay and promptly got arrested. So the history of left-wing politics and of anti-colonial politics and anti-imperialist politics is very long and as old as the South Asian diaspora. Unlike, you know, what the figures of the highest median income according to ethnic group would let you to believe. Then I'll just talk quickly about what the current landscape looks like, and I think that's where this panel becomes important. So since 90s, there has been a rise in South Asians taking increasing part and role within union movements, within civil society movements, within nonprofits. Their roles have increased since the 90s. And what you see there is the next change that happens after the 90s is post 9/11, where you have the rise of organizations like DRUM, which Mohiba would talk about, of SALT, which was very important South Asian Americans leading together that formed a coalition of national coalition of different South Asian organizations. For instance, in 2011, there was a big protest organized in New York City by 100 imams coming together from 100 different mosques, which mobilized like socialists, civil society groups, and everyone who was attending those 100 mosques. as an anti-imperialist, anti-war, and anti-racist protest. So this has come a long way from them being just professionalized classes, which is where, I mean, the professionalized classes is the backbone of the prosperity you see amongst, like, particularly Indian and Pakistani Americans. So the current landscape within that context is a bit varied. So on, I'll just list out different themes of what the landscape looks like, and there are obviously overlaps, but just to, you know, simplify for today. So there is, on the, one, you have service provision organizations, which are hyper-local, like, for instance, Adhikar, which serves Nepali salon workers in Queens, New York, Chaya, which serves small homeowners and tenant rights advocacy work, both working with very specific communities in local regions, and general support, like Sakhi, that deals with gender-based violence, and Sapna, that deals with access to healthcare and health programs for South Asian women. So that's one set of organizations that are primarily service provision organizations. The other is civil society groups. There you have organizations like India Civil Watch International, India IAMC, Indian American Muslim Council, Hindus for Human Rights. Some of them are also presenting at panels around here, which do advocacy work and intervene in the broader U.S. civil society space, working with elected representatives to pressurize them about issues, particularly on anti-fascist lines that are coming from different regions in South Asia, and also with international organizations to pressurize different states in South Asia. Then you have base building and community organizations like DRUM, like the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, which do grassroots work of mobilizing and organizing local communities and politicizing them and building power so to fight and pressurize and change laws that are more favorable for the needs of the communities. And then you have activist organizations like South Asia Solidarity Initiative, ASATA in the Bay Area. In Chicago, you have Chicago Desis Rising. And all of these organizations, you know, are generally responding to crises that are happening within different South Asian regions. So they're focusing on, like, organizing protests in front of embassies, releasing statements, doing, like, political education work and programming. So that, I mean, that's, like, sort of like the broad range of where you can find, like, left-wing forces and these different sets of themes of the organizations. So the South Asian diaspora in these conditions, I think, has created a space to build and hold community that can go beyond and against nation states. And I think that's very significant, because this is, these conditions don't exist within South Asia itself. It's really strange how, like, we have to come here to meet people from Pakistan if you are from India. And so I think there is, like, a social base here that people live, work, and struggle together from across countries within this region that only happens in the diaspora, that is under current political conditions is not possible as a political project within South Asia itself. And so I think that's sort of the significance of where we are trying to get at with just putting this panel together and broadening up that conversation, because I think we are at a very significant moment within the context of the demographics and the position that South Asians occupy in the US, and within the context of the political conditions within South Asia itself, and the influence of both of them. So Salaam, the organization that I come from, is an attempt amongst many to take this history forward in that way. It's an attempt to say that, okay, these are organizations that are doing different kinds of work, which are all very useful in putting together a political organization that can unite these forces. So we don't have to repeat the work. We don't have to start anew. We can build together based on that. Yeah, and just a final note. Sorry, I've just been going on for too long. that we understand South Asia as a point of departure. It's not an end in itself. It's a strategic geography for us. Strategic because consolidating this political formation is one step towards international and anti-national communism, is how we are looking at it. And geographic because we are against homogenizing any kind of identity, whether it's cultural or otherwise, across the region. So it's purely strategic, and we are driven and we are drawn to South Asia, I mean, primarily because of its historic ties, geographic proximity, and our own like better understanding of working within that context, whether it's within South Asia or in the diaspora. I'll stop there.
Thank you for this detailed exposition. So now we understand that diaspora, as we understand, is not really a monolith identity. When we speak of diaspora, there's sort of like a similar uneven development, just like South Asia, perhaps, where at the same time you have South Asian communities in the top 10 highest earning communities in the US. But at the same time, these same communities are also communities that are at the back end of the massive wage theft that is happening. So they are working in restaurants, they are working in taxi drivers. So you have rich South Asians in North America, but also you have thousands of workers that essentially hold cities like New York on their shoulders. Because if they essentially, if they disappear, then the city might not work, because you won't have taxi drivers, you won't have restaurant workers, you won't have retail workers, you won't have care workers. So on that context, I think we should move forward now to what are the current challenges of organizing this diaspora. And I'll ask Divyani to talk about the Canadian context here as well. And based on what Aman, let's take the history and context provided by Aman, and let's take that forward and talk about the current challenges. So what has your experience been working with Jamhur, and what are the major challenges of essentially organizing not on ethnic or identity lines, but what are the challenges moving into the class anti-imperialist international lens that we want South Asian organizing to be? So what is the current situation? What are the challenges, if you can talk about it?
Thanks. That's a loaded question. I think so. I don't know how many Canadians are here, but we. Okay, great. Thanks. Oh my God, this is good. yeah. So I mean, in Canada, so that obviously overlaps with you know everything that Aman spoke about the U.S. But there are also very critical divergences, right, in terms of like who came there, because of the immigration policies, et cetera. So while Ghadar is such a critical moment for all of the South Asians in North America, post-Ghadar, there's a whole politics that develops and organizations that emerge around that politics in Canada, which I think is not happening as much. Like, the trajectories kind of shift post that. Because it's largely, so beginning from the rail workers who come late 19th century to build the railways here, this is how they first arrive on the West Coast in Vancouver. From then, the second next big wave is of the farmers who come again on the West Coast. And so initially what you see in the 70s then is these big farm workers unions. So one of the first ones, which is the CFU, Canadian Farm Worker Union, it's being led, organized by Punjabi workers who land on the West Coast. And then there simultaneously, I think 1 or 2 years before that, emerges another committee, which is the East India Defense Committee, again led by Punjabi Sikh workers on the West Coast. So in that sense, there are little differences in terms of what's happening in the US compared to what's happening in Canada. US, with the immigration, you know, when that shift happened, that is when I think Kamala Harris's parents landed here, when they allowed only professionals to come in. So that shift doesn't happen as much for Canada. Canada, like it's labor, farm workers, again, like different kinds of workers who are constantly coming in, especially in the post-decolonization phase. And then that has been informing the politics till date. Those waves of workers coming in has sort of been constant in a sense. And recently, it's international students who come as students, but then primarily are the workforce in Canada. And now a lot of organizing, for instance, has had to shift to that, adapt to that, and see, you know, what can be done with this. So that's the moment we're in right now. But this longer genealogy of left organizing, led by Punjabi Sikh workers, definitely has contributed to the moment we are in now as well. Also because the biggest Sikh population outside of India, Punjabi population outside of India or South Asia, is in Canada. So then, you know, like as I think it, we've already discussed how South Asia or South Asians is like a whole thing. It's not one thing, right? So while they're in you know, the defense minister is a Sikh, but then some of these founders of these strong unions were also Sikh. So then, you know, you're in direct contradiction in several ways. And I think that is still happening. So like drawing on that, there are several movements that have emerged. Like Jamhoor is primarily a media platform for South Asians. So while we connect with a lot of organizing on the ground that is happening in and around Toronto and the GTA, there's a whole lot of movements on the West Coast, which are just like this sort of continued fight that, you know, like has been building on one organization after the other. And I think it's very important to be cognizant of that because we're constantly posed as a model minority. And then model minority model, like it's coming from a very specific class and caste, like a tiny fraction of South Asians here, right? So this project cannot be like, if we don't sort of go back to the history and don't build on that, then we will just keep selling it, like it'll keep selling. So given that background, Jamhoor, but also like several other organizations, and I will talk about one. And then I think because Arslan has been an organizer for like over a decade, so I will let him speak for that. But for instance, two of the organizations currently, which are, one is called Nojavan Support Network, so Youth Support Network, is again being led by Punjabi workers in Brampton, in the GTA, organizing like through direct action around wage theft, around exploitation of workers by other South Asians. So that's the thing, right? There's so many contradictions within the South Asian community that seldom are spoken about. And they have become quite a force. They have been able to recover over $700,000-$800,000 of wages in the last 2 years, probably, if I'm not wrong. I'm not very good with years and dates and months. So that's one. And, you know, obviously there are challenges that they're running into, that what do you do beyond this, right? Like what is the broader political project, et cetera. And then there are organizations like the South Asian Dalit and Adivasi Network, which again we work closely with, who are trying to organize, because caste has rarely been a question when we talk about the diaspora, anything related to diaspora. So here is an organization who's trying to really center that in the diaspora discussions that are then happening in the GTA, right? And then I think we often come together in different formats. And we can, like, I can elaborate on this. We can elaborate on this going further. But I hope I addressed the question.
Yeah,
thank you.
Arsalan, if you can talk about the organizing part and take this
problem. Yeah, so I mean, I'm going to just extend what Aman and Tivyani put together. So again, a very differentiated community on ethnic lines. And what are the borders of South Asia even, right? Like, and I'm coming from the Canadian context. Some of it is similar, some of it isn't. But yeah, as Tivyani said, you have, I mean, in the States, I think... a lot of doctors were brought in, a lot of Pakistani doctors exist, very wealthy. That's not the case necessarily in Canada, although there's the North Indian Hindu community is one of the wealthiest, I think, minorities in Canada. But you don't have that whole section of like petty B kind of doctors and like really rich doctors in Canada. You have the Tamil community is huge. So Toronto is the largest population of Tamils anywhere outside Asia, basically in a city. And most of them immigrated from 1970s to 2000s during the Civil War and to escape genocide in Sri Lanka. And they've had multi-generational organizations. In 2009, when the Civil War was happening, they blocked highways in Toronto, like the Gardner was blocked, and like they showed their massive presence there. The Sikh community, as you said, like Divyani touched on it, many of them all were involved in leftist projects, also involved in like Khalistan-related organizing, which is of a different kind, nationalist organizations. Pakistani community, I can't think of, in Vancouver, they were part of like some of the working class movements, but a lot of, as Aman said, a lot of PTI supporters, Imran Khan supporters, or like mainstream nationalism works in Toronto as well. But then there as well, most of the Pakistanis are actually Punjabis. So you find in workplaces, Punjabi Pakistanis are closer to Indian Punjabis in workplaces and this and that, whereas Pashtuns, like, you know, Pakistani Pashtuns may not be. So, you know, you find in the diaspora some different communities form. It's not necessarily like this is the Pakistani community, this is the Indian community. In terms of organizing, what's difficult is you have the first generation that comes in. Historically, a lot of leftists came from India and this and that, but then more recently, and that project wasn't the same in Pakistan, you find a lot of people who are kind of interested in connecting to politics in Pakistan, but not necessarily moving on the conditions they're faced with in Canada. A lot of people come in accepting the meager kind of conditions they're offered. As first generation, they don't have the assertiveness. They don't feel like they could assert themselves in this land. They feel like they need, the immigration process is so long. It's actually longer in America. I find the Canadian was also really long, right? And during that time, you find like those people really hesitant to organize. But then the second generation is a different deal. They feel like, you know, they've been bullied in school. They face Islamophobia. They feel Canadian and they're not being recognized as Canadian. So there's a different set of strategies that people have employed trying to organize those people. And what I've noticed is, apart from some communities, you don't find a lot of intergenerational organizations. You find like the parents were part of a different movement or a different type of organizing related to their politics back home, whereas the new generation wants to engage more with the politics in Canada or in their society and, like, you know, those issues. In terms of my own kind of background and the organizations I've worked with and the kind of conclusions I've drawn, I'm sure there's people here who know a lot more about this, but what we faced in Toronto was that you had this core downtown left, right? Like, coming out of university spaces, very radicalized, really, like, identity, there was a phase of identity politics and, like, really coming out to protest. But then you went into the suburbs where most of working class people have been pushed in Toronto. There's been a massive shift in the last 15 years where families have been pushed to inner suburbs, ghettos, and, like, you know, outer suburbs. And you went and spoke to them, and they were actually not part of that organizing effort at all, right? They were not part of the downtown campaigns that were being run, either the May Day rallies or any sort of leftist formation. Completely kind of out of that, and you saw this disconnect between the two, and that's when, like, a couple of organizations popped up that I felt have done incredible work in trying to kind of politicize those communities. I mean, I hate, like, using this term as if, like, there's, like, a subject and object and, like, you know, where there's some group going there and politicizing people and then they're gonna come up. But basically, the idea was that, and I'd like to mention one particular group, People's Defense. It came out of a critique of organizations that just focus on the downtown left and make a lot of noise. But then when you go to working class communities, they're not part of this movement at all, right? Their issues are different. Their issues are paying rent, right? Getting food on the table. And like the US, the lessening of the union kind of power. The union membership has decreased by 10% in the last 20 years. It's, I think, at 30% right now. But also the type of unions we have in, unfortunately, Canada. Some of them are doing incredible work now, but at the same time, they have lost a lot of power, especially in the manufacturing sector. Formal labor has taken, like, a hit big time because of neoliberalization and this and that. So a lot of people and immigrants and South Asians are included in this group are surviving on precarious jobs, you know, jobs that don't allow them to kind of work in one place for a long time where they can build real communities at their workplaces. So the idea was to actually organize people in their communities instead of their workplaces, and their housing became a big thing because of housing unaffordability. That's happening here too, but in Canada, it's housing prices went up by 5 times in the last 15 years and or 20 years. And during COVID, the rental prices have gone up by 30% or 50%, right? Like, the 600 square feet apartment in downtown Toronto is like $3,000 or something. So you don't find, like, you find a complete, and wages haven't, right? People are losing jobs, taxis are non-existent. A lot of Pakistani, actually 50% of the taxi workforce was Pakistani in Toronto. Now they're all Uber drivers, and you know how Uber works and this and that. So the idea is to now somehow organize people in either informal labor or their communities where they live, right? And that's a huge challenge. And you know, I was actually popped up in this bookstore that they have here, and I read this quote, and fits. It's a very simple quote, but it fits so well with what needs to be done. It's like, as organizers, beyond believing in people, we have to build with them, right? And the problem with a lot of these organizations that go into these neighborhoods, right? First of all, if it's a Pakistani neighborhood, you find these white organizations looking for Pakistani organizers who can speak their language, sit with them, have a cup of tea, and somehow organize them, right? And then there's also these organizations that have a very vanguardist approach. They've already figured out we have to go from A to B to revolution. And so, like, you know, they're having conversations with people, but you know they have ulterior motives, agendas, and like, so I know the approach that People's Defense takes to form tenant unions, and they've successfully formed two or three tenant unions in the Toronto suburbs in predominantly Muslim communities, is not to actually have those ultimate goals, but build the organization with them through working class leadership. And if the leadership is not being reproduced, then that project is not, it's meant to not succeed. NSN is another organization, like Divyani mentioned, the Nojawan Support Network. Instead of becoming a casework organization, and that's the line, right? You're doing serve the people, but you don't want to become an NGO, and you don't want to become caseworkers. But they, through organizing people at their site of labor, against actually petty Indian capitalists. So we're also fighting South Asians, right? We're fighting Hindutva. We're fighting, like, you know, truck owners who are not paying their people wages. You make them fight their own battles, right? And you work with them to then say that, you know, this is not just about this one case, but the condition for us to fight for you is that you will help us fight for these other folks. And then the other challenge is then how do you connect it to the wider left struggle? Around Palestine, we saw amazing solidarities. I mean, especially in the Muslim community, because they don't require a lot of convincing on the issue. So that was one point of success. But yeah, with Hindutva on the rise, as well as, you know, Hindutva is also on the rise in working class communities in the diaspora, it's not so clear cut, right? How do you then kind of organize people not around just their issues that they're facing in the diaspora, but also connect them to back Pakistan, India, wherever they're from, and to the wider struggle remains a challenge. And yeah, I'm sure many people in this panel deal with the same challenge.
That makes a lot of sense. And this is going to be the last question before we move to the audience, and we want to give it as much time as we can. Generally, we've seen that organizing in among the diaspora is a difficult task because of all the nuances within their composition, and especially when we talk about South Asia. Another factor is that when diaspora moves, they do not retain their class identities. So they might be belonging to some other class back home, but once they leave and come to a new homeland, perhaps not exactly a homeland, they operate as a different class. And I remember this particular quote from a South Asian professor that I used to study from. And he essentially represents this age-old stereotype about South Asians, that they're only good to have biryani and chai with. Don't bother organizing with them because it's not going to happen. So, and Muhiba here has worked as a base-building organizer for the last year and a half. And when we talk about base building, we can only base build around working class issues. I want to really understand your experience about this, how this class formation occurs, and what has been your experience in organizing along these lines.
Okay. So Thank you, Raza, for pointing out one of the, I think, biggest difficulty that we have as organizers here is when we go into a community of working class people and they do not want to be recognized as working class people. They're like, you know, we come from middle class families back home. We own a house back home. We are not working class, and we don't think that there is dignity in being working class. And that's a big, big challenge that you face as an organizer when you go in a working class community there. And that is the reality of a lot of like South Asian communities here. We talk about the Bengali community, when we talk about the Nepali community, when we talk about the Pakistani community, this is where they're coming from. Because they might be working 15 hours a day here, 7 days a week, and they would be sending money back home, and they would be able to afford those things back home, which they can't afford over here. And still they would think that, you know, because they are coming from the sense of the working class as it exists back in the home countries, and the working class as it exists back in the home countries is very different from as it exists in the United States. And that is one of the cultural shocks that I got to face as well, coming here as an international student 3 years ago. And, you know, then I got into, like, you know, political spaces like Salaam, and then I got engaged with Drum. And that is what I will be focusing on today, like my experience of organizing the Pakistani community in New York City, in Little Pakistan, Coney Island Avenue area, which was one of the most targeted areas after 9/11, where the community could not be organized for 2 decades straight. And like the successes and lessons that I learned as an organizer, you know, organizing the Pakistani community there, and what was happening in the past 2 decades that the people were not able to be organized, and then, you know, what changed in the past 2 years that we've been able to successfully form base in Little Pakistan, in an area that's heavily policed, in an area that has so many NYPD, what do you call them, liaisons?
Community patrol liaisons.
And so the community is a very heavily policed. The Pakistani community in New York City is very heavily policed, completely working class neighborhood. And that's the work of Drum. So I'll just, sort of overview what kind of work Drum does. Drum was an organization that came into being in like 1999, 2000, and basically started like the work in 2001 after the 9/11 attacks, because it started as like a crisis management organization, where there were like a group of lawyers coming together. They were getting calls left, right, and center from people like, you know, my son has been picked up, my brother has been picked up, and they knew nothing. Like, the community did not know how to be able to face that or like manage that. And so the people in Drum were helping these people out after, like, you know, the attack after 9/11 on the Muslim communities in Beirut, where the Arab community is, and then Little Pakistan, Coney Island Avenue, where the Pakistani community. So these were the two communities that were most affected in New York City after 9/11. But what happened because of that was that there were so many undocumented people who were being picked up by, you know, the NYPD, the ICE, all of these different organizations, the FBI. And, you know, we were, at that point in time, Drum was only looking at managing the crisis at hand, which is, you know, making sure that the people who are going missing, we should be able to recognize where they are, help them out, bail them out. And as a result, we were able to have, like, you know, presence in the community, like, very quickly. Like, the community started realizing, okay, this is Drum, this is the organization that is helping us out with, our people, all of that. But because the majority of the community was undocumented people, what happened just 1 year after was that we had about 800 to 1,000 members. We were able to do that in about a year because of like the crisis management that we were doing. But in the next 2 years, our membership was to zero again because all of them were deported. So we had to start from scratch again, and that's when we made the assessment that you cannot only do crisis management. Crisis management cannot be the only way to base build. You need to be within the people. This needs to be a long-term project. You need to build the leadership of the people so that they can also have the capacity to be able to base build themselves, and there has to be a long presence in the community. But then the problem arises that how do you go back to a community that is frightened beyond belief? Like, they know the cost of doing politics. They know the cost of base building. They know that if we engage in any kind of politics, we're going to be thrown out of the country, right? And so they were wary of, like, engaging with any politics whatsoever. They did not want to do it. And so for 2 decades, like all of my comrades have mentioned, that the, because South Asian is also like, they, you know, it's a linguistic, there's so many languages within the community, there are so many ethnicities. So all of the, these become hurdles in the way of base building. Because then you need organizers that are skilled within that language, that are skilled within those cultures, that are skilled within, like, you know, the ethnic dynamics of, like, engaging with people. So it was just really difficult for people to gain, like, you know, just to gain the trust of the communities that were there, because they were like, how do we know you're not working with the NYPD? How do we know that you're not the person with the NYPD? And that's the same thing that happened with me 3 years ago when I came. I am a person who came from Pakistan, right? And I decided that there is a need to organize, and I went to the Pakistan community that I will organize there. I started talking to people. I started to get a sense of, like, what the issues are, why are they so frightened, and all of that. And immediately in 6 months, I was tagged as an NYPD informant. That this person, don't talk to this woman. Because this woman speaks good Urdu, but there might be a reason why she's speaking good Urdu. Yeah, she wants to take information out of all of us. And so it was very difficult to be able to gain the trust of those people. But then we had to shift tactics. And unfortunately, October 7th happened. The Palestine, you know, the incident happened. And that is where we were like, because all of the other organizations within the community were only service organizations. Those were the only organizations that were allowed to exist in that community. NYPD did not allow any other kind of political organization to be present there. They had their own ethnic associations in the neighborhood, and they were like, we will not have any other organization present there. So they were so afraid to talk about Palestine. And Palestine is an issue where you don't need to convince the Muslim people a lot to you know, support that. And even, like, despite having, like, that kind of support, people were afraid to speak up because they were like, we don't want to be picked up by the NYPD. And the problem was that the masjids, the mosques, were infiltrated by these NYPD, folks. And so people could not even speak. They did not even pray about Palestine within the mosque because they were like, somebody from the NYPD would hear it and then we would be in trouble again. And so what we did was, as Drum, that we started to do direct actions within the community. In a community where direct actions hadn't happened in decades, we did direct actions within the community. And people saw that as, you know, they were surprised by it, but they also got inspiration from it, that if they were able to do a direct action for Palestine within our neighborhood, and there was a lot of NYPD, mind you, like, 2 whole streets were filled by NYPD, the protest was of 50 people. Right? And so, but they were not able to, you know, touch us because we were not doing anything illegal. Protest is a right. But people were so frightened that they weren't able to recognize that, you know, it is a right that you can have. And so when they saw us, like 50 people doing it in front of, like, more than, like, 100 police officers standing there, they were like, if they can go unharmed by it, we can also do this. So there emerges a counter narrative, a powerful alternative that we give them, that, you know, you can raise your voice against the NYPD, and you have the right to do it. And so slowly and steadily, that became the way in which we started to base build. We started to go into institutions again as, like, an opposition to the NYPD, but, you know, did not talk to the people directly about NYPD, because if you talk directly, they would not be able to trust you, because, like, they have to do something about the NYPD, that's why they're talking about it, right? So we weren't talking about it, but our work was a way of showing them that we are an alternative to them. We were doing security trainings on our own after 9/11, because hate crimes increased in our neighborhood. Hate crimes increased in Bay Ridge. Immediately after October 7, we started getting calls that the hate crimes, like, you know, were increasing. And so we took those things on. We made sure that, you know, we were able to deal with all of those things. And so that the community started to have, like, faith in themselves again, that we can protect ourselves. We do not need the NYPD. The only reason NYPD has been able to exist with such a strong hold in that community is because the people thought that they were protecting us. They're there to protect us. Or they're fearful of them. But when they realize that the alternative is that we can protect ourselves, then, you know, you're able to form that trust again. So I think that that is just a little anecdote of, like, you know, how we were able, in a place where for two decades we weren't able to make any kind of interventions, that's how we were able to build a base in that kind of neighborhood and provide an alternative to the people and build the leadership of the people that now they're taking on leadership themselves, not only within the community, but they were able to topple the management of the mosques that were with the NYPD, and now our leaders are sitting in those mosques, and they are the ones that are making the decisions.
The NYPD currently spends millions in something called community policing, which essentially is a group of community liaisons who are not directly employed by the NYPD, but operate as voluntary community patrols within the community. And there have been multiple cases where we have seen them essentially acting as informants and being placed within certain mosques. In 2011, a big news story came out that 250 mosques were being surveilled 24/7 in the New York and surrounding areas, which is like the main question about. So these are the people who are being employed with these millions are also South Asians. So we also see that diaspora has been susceptible to right-wing state narratives. We've seen Imran Khan is the most popular leader in the Pakistani diaspora. The Hindutva is popular substantially in the diaspora. And this is not just about popularity. This is about actual resources that support and maintain structures back home. So half of Imran Khan's or PTI's funding comes from the diaspora. In last year, somebody in Texas told us that one group in Texas was sending $80,000 per month to PTI back home. And to anyone who's recently been to Pakistan, $80,000, I can't even calculate. It's too much. And the election campaign was happening. So I would have loved to ask that question to take it forward about what are the methods of organization through which the right wing has taken so much space among the diaspora? Is it the age-old conundrum about the fact that the right wing only succeeds where the left fails? Because since we were not there, they were there? Or are there literal lessons to be learned from the right wing? I'm always up to do that. Fascists organize really well. And this is an important lesson from history. Even within South Asian communities, you see RSS, you see the Hindutva groups or Jamaat-e-Islam in Pakistan. They have massive, like, well thought out organization plans. But before I can take that question to the panel, I would ask the audience if they have any comments or questions, and maybe this question can be addressed during that process. So we can take like two or three comments or questions then first, and then maybe we can talk about them. So.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.